everybody, and thank you for joining us for the Preceptor Podcast. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Ryan. And today we have with us one of our colleagues, Dr. Mark Bonfiglio. Would you like to introduce yourself, Mark?
Sure. This is Mark. I'm happy to be here to talk about a subject that's near and dear to my heart.
So we're really excited to have Mark come and talk to us today because he's going to be talking to us a little bit about the development of the COVID-19 vaccinations and kind of what's been going on with those and why this has been a unique vaccination to develop. And I think one of the things that I really wanted to ask about first is I've heard even in the lay media a little bit about spike proteins and how they've been used in conjunction with COVID-19 vaccines. Can you tell us what spike proteins are for maybe some of us who are not as into this as others and why they're important in this instance?
Sure. A lot of attention focused on the spike protein. I think one of the reasons spike protein gets so much attention is it is a very visible physical aspect of the coronavirus. When you look at them under an electron microscope, you see these spike proteins, and they really project out very noticeably from the surface of the virus. It actually gives it its sort of characteristic shape, and on electron microscopy, it actually appeared to look something like a crown, because crowns have this round shape, and then these, you know, things that are normally jeweled sticking out from their surface. The corona means crown, so that gives it a very characteristic appearance. So it isn't just the fact that it's visible. It happens to be a very important protein in terms of the ability of the virus to locate susceptible cells. And if you can think about this as being almost like fingers extending from the surface of the virus. It's scanning, it's searching, it's looking for a receptor, a very specific receptor, and almost functions kind of like a lock and a key. If it finds the right receptor, it can attach. And once that attachment takes place, this particular spike protein is vital to the recognition and the eventual entry of the virus particle into its host cell. So if it doesn't have a good functioning spike protein, and if it can't find its complementary receptor, then infection can't occur. So if we can target the spike protein, number one, it's a protein that's expressed outside of the virus cell that makes it accessible to antibody. And if we can find an antibody that somehow interferes with that binding or interferes with that entry process, we've got a suitable target to develop vaccines around that would generate antibody, hopefully, to neutralize the activity of that spike protein. So it's not just that it's visible, it's also extremely important to the appropriate recognition. That's why it becomes such an important target for vaccines.
That's really interesting. And I didn't know, I guess I never even put together corona and crown. So thank you for that. But it's great information.
It's not just a beer.
Always a good reminder, certainly. So I know there are a number of different vaccines currently in the pipeline and under development. Can you highlight maybe a couple of the different types of vaccines and what makes them different from one and another?
Sure. There are three kind of front runners in the vaccine derby, if you will, right now, and we can talk a little bit about each one of them. I think first off, it probably deserves mention that vaccinology has progressed so far beyond what many people think of. You know, many people go back to the days when we would take a live virus and we would try to make it less infective, and we'd inject the whole virus and hope for good things to happen. We understand more detail about how immunity is generated. So the technologies that are being used to generate viruses today very often take bits and pieces of different types of viruses and join them together and create these things, or they're using individual molecules. So when we go through these three kind of primary candidates, we'll talk a little bit about what distinguishes them and what type of technology they're based on. The first one is the Oxford vaccine. That's the one that it's probably entered clinical trials earliest. It's based on what's called a virus vector. So you take a virus that's a relatively benign virus, in this case it's an adenovirus, and doesn't cause particularly, you know, even the intact virus doesn't cause particularly severe disease. And you kind of carve out some of its genetic material and you sneak in genetic material that's associated with the creation, in this case, with the spike protein. So you allow that infection to take place, and it's going to produce spike protein, which is then going to trigger an immune reaction from the host, not against an intact coronavirus, but it brings about immunity to the coronavirus because you fooled the cells into producing that spike protein in a way that it'll display it to the immune cells of the human body, stimulate a reaction to that protein. So the Oxford virus is an adenovirus vector, very similar to the technology that was used to produce the first Ebola vaccine. So this is a strategy that's really starting to come into play. You don't ever expose somebody to the actual coronavirus entire apparatus. The second virus is really kind of an interesting one. This is the Moderna virus that you may have heard of, people might have. This is a vaccine technology that is very new. It's based on messenger RNA and only messenger RNA. So if you can get messenger RNA into the inside of a cell, this is messenger RNA is essentially what is used by the cell normally to transfer the genetic material in the nucleus and pass it out into the cytoplasm, into the general cell components, and it will be taken up by ribosomes and translated into protein. So we're not even injecting the spike protein here. We're just injecting the messenger RNA, and it can be taken up. There are a lot of modifications to that RNA that can be done and have been sort of optimized over the last 10 to 20 years so that it will cause those cells to begin to produce that spike protein without any virus particle ever being exposed to that person. Novel technique, novel technology. One of the things that people are uncertain of is this would be the first mRNA vaccine used in humans. So some people pause at that, but, you know, there it leaves a lot left in terms of unknown aspects of how people will tolerate that, how effective will it be. But in terms of rapid development of a vaccine, this strategy is faster than any technology that's been seen before. This was developed in 42 days after the release of the genome. So lightning type speed. And it's actually part of the speed was this really kind of was built on the backs of some research that was done with other coronaviruses like SARS and MERS. So you know, in the future, this might be an even more rapid development process. It's really pretty fascinating.
So is that one in clinical trials yet?
Yes, that one's in phase 3 trials.
Okay.
And then the third group are the Pfizer vaccines. And Pfizer did whatever any good large pharmaceutical company did. They went out and bought a company that was already producing these vaccines. It's a shortcut. It gets you there faster. These are also mRNA vaccines, various modifications introduced and slightly different technology employed. One of them is actually a self-amplifying mRNA, which means that it actually brings along coding for proteins that will actually make more copies of the mRNA once it's inside the cells. So you tend to think that would produce a more robust immune response. So those are the three kind of leading candidates. Sorry to say, I can't really comment about this Russian vaccine because I don't think anybody really knows what they're testing out there. But obviously, they're the first to license a vaccine. I just don't know what that really means.
So these kind of three vaccines, or the two plus the little group from Pfizer, are the ones right now that are on at the end of August when we're recording this, are the ones right now that look we're going to get some sort of answer about either positive or negative first.
Yeah. So if you're looking at this as a horse race, these three have separated themselves from the pack. Doesn't mean there aren't other horses in the race. They're just further back away from the lead pack. Doesn't mean that one of those might not emerge later on, but these three probably have the strongest support at this time, the inside track, if you will, to be first.
And we talk about vaccinations. I know there's some vaccinations that are a one and done vaccination. There are some, many of them require boosters. Are we looking at this as a one and done? Is this going to be something that's probably a yearly? Is it something in between? Any thoughts about where, you know, knowing the nature of a coronavirus and how it works, do you have any thoughts about how that's going to look?
Yeah, so kind of two elements to that. There's sort of what does it take to establish an initial response? And unfortunately, it appears that the vaccines right now in early clinical research have been shown that they really need a booster. They can't be a one and done vaccine. And that is really, unfortunately, slowing down some of the research because you can't just give a dose today and a dose tomorrow. That doesn't work that way. Generally, it's separated by 6 to 8 weeks is the schedule that we're on. So you, in terms of accumulating data, you have to wait at least 2 months before you've even given your second dose. So the data coming in terms of efficacy are going to be delayed because of that. And then the second and extremely important question is, how long does it last? Will this be a one and done type vaccine? We certainly have those vaccines where you get vaccinated once and it lasts a lifetime. And a lot of that depends on not just the ability to produce antibody, but the ability to stimulate T cell responses as well. And T cell responses, they do a lot of things. They mature the antibody response. They will allow the antibody to become more specific to the antigen. They will also cause isotype switching with T cell help. But most importantly, they're responsible for the generation of memory cells. And to establish good memory, you need T cell help. And another component of that T cell stimulation that deserves mention is, you know, T cells also can target infected cells. So cytotoxic responses also rely on T cells. So I think there's way too much emphasis placed on just the production of antibody. And the T cell memory and those kind of functions are things that you can't really know much about until you're in these clinical trials. It's important that the trials be done well and that the data be scrutinized.
Okay. I know also that the frequency of having to do a revaccination can also go to the ability of the virus to mutate. And is coronavirus a virus that tends to mutate pretty easily and pretty rapidly, or is it one that doesn't mutate as much?
Yeah, and unfortunately, the simple answer to that question is coronaviruses are, there's a form that's very commonly associated with the common cold. And we've never really been able to eliminate the common cold because it mutates so often. Now, I would kind of stress that there's another part to this story, though. There are elements of the coronavirus that mutate very rapidly, but there are certain elements of the coronavirus that cannot mutate or that you don't have an effective virus. And what researchers are trying to do is target elements on the spike protein that are relatively stable. And if they are successful in doing that, then it may not matter as much what mutations are taking place in different parts of the protein. If the core elements are targeted and neutralized, that bodes well for the durability of the vaccine. It remains to be seen, but that's sort of what's being targeted at least.
Mark, this is really good information. And I'm hearkening back to my days in immunology class, and it's all coming back to me. So thank you for this reminder. For our preceptors out there who are going to be working with patients and who everyone has this question about, you know, COVID-19 and vaccines, what information do you think is most important for our preceptors to share with patients?
Oh, there's so much. There's so much bad information out there that really just being a source for good quality information. I think, you know, people are wondering why does it take so long for these vaccines to be developed? What are the risks of these vaccines once they occur? I think from a safety perspective, because of these new technologies, the safety of these vaccines is likely to be greater than past vaccines. You know, you're not injecting a live virus. You're injecting messenger RNA. So it's likely to be safer than the risks that you have with other viruses. But there's also the unknown that people will react to that, you know, it's never been used before. And we've got a lot of history of bad information about viruses. It's very discouraging to hear that up to 40% of the population have said that they would reject vaccination, even if it were available. I think understanding sort of the benefit, not just to you, but to your communities, those are the kind of things that I would tend to emphasize with caregivers.
I think day one, I'm in line signing up because I want to go out and do things and see people again.
Yeah, this mythical herd of immunity that we're all striving for, it's hard to turn that down. Yeah, but the other thing is going to be sort of expectation setting. There are very few vaccines that are 100% effective. And the fact that we're likely to see at least a 2-injection sequence, if you get it once, it's not good enough. So to be clear on what those expectations might be, I think that's useful to know.
Mark, thank you so much for discussing the finer points of the COVID-19 vaccinations and really bringing to the forefront some of that important information. Thank you so much.
There is one last thing that I would like to, because it's very timely right now, and that is an understanding of the other type of immunity, which is passive immunity, which is acquired by something like convalescent plasma. And I don't want to go too long here, but I do want to at least mention what it is and what some of the downsides are of convalescent plasma. Not that there aren't positive sides, but basically it's just taking plasma from somebody who's recovered from the illness and infusing that with the antibodies that have been generated by that individual during the infection. And the hope is that you're transferring some of that immunity to the recipient. One of the downsides of convalescent plasma is you don't know the quality of the antibody you're receiving. When people generate an antibody response, some of them generate very specific and very effective antibody, and others may not. When you look at it as a pool, there's a lot of antibody that's created that might bind to the virus, but it's not what is called neutralizing antibody. So it binds it. Yeah, that's wonderful. But if it can't neutralize the infection, then it's not particularly effective. And each individual has a little bit different profile on that. So when you're receiving convalescent plasma, it's a little bit of a luck of the draw. If you got lucky and got somebody who's got good antibody, that's great. And that was part of what researchers were kind of complaining about by kind of truncating the studies. The other part of convalescent plasma to be aware of is you're not stimulating T cell immunity. So the opportunity to develop memory or cytotoxic responses by T cells is absent there. There are a number of companies that are developing monoclonal antibodies that are much more specific and much more likely to have a direct predictable effect. But obviously those are also associated with a much higher cost than something that's been donated. So that's sort of just to complete the picture of vaccines and where we are in terms of immunologic manipulations of this virus. Because it's a timely subject, I just thought we should try and toss that in there.
Thank you so much, Mark, for taking some time to speak with us today. I really think it's a wealth of information that you've shared. So thank you.
Good. Happy to talk about it, obviously, I hope.
Yes, very much so. And thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Pharmacy Preceptor podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please like or subscribe. We would love your feedback on topics that interest you and how we can make this podcast better. Please submit your comments to help us develop content that best serves you. Thank you, everyone.